Hello, comrade bitches. This is Monica Estrella Negra with another lovely episode of Bitches on Comics. And of course, I am here today with one of my favorite people and my wonderful co-host, Essie Fleenor.
Resident comrade bitch. I love comrade bitches. Like, I'm like, you know what? Forget the lovely bitches. You're all now comrade bitches. And that's beautiful.
I mean, in these times, that's all I'm
Listen,
saying.
Listen, if there was ever a day that called for it. Hi, folks. I'm Essie Fleenor. You probably know my voice by now. And if you don't, like, that's cool. Hi. Nice to meet you. Where you been? I'm leaving a blank so you can reply. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, no. I am so delighted because a real life person is here with us today who will respond to my questions. Why would I do that? Why would I do that? I am so delighted to welcome Vera Drew. Vera, thank you so much for being here. We're so excited. Listeners, Vera Drew is an Emmy-nominated film editor, the director, writer, and star of The People's Joker, also known as the better Joker film with musical elements. And we are just so delighted to have you here with us, Vera. Thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thanks so much for having me. Your interactive portion of the intro really, like, it like reset my brain function. It was like I got MK Ultra'd or something. I had a second where I was like, oh, that makes sense. Like, I guess that's like a thing that people do now. And then I was like, no, that can't be. But it was cool either way. I hope you keep it in.
You're like, that can't be right. No one would do that. I'm like, well, you know, I'm just on this bend of ruining all the beautiful things I build. Wait a minute. Let's not get into that. Let's save that for another day.
Come on.
It's called jokes. Ugh, we had the whole conversation, listeners, before we started. I was like, yada, 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 self-deprecating jokes, self-deprecating this. And Vera was like, as long as it doesn't go too far. And I think Monica just said, bitch, you're going too far. So, yeah. Fine. I don't hate myself on a technicality.
Don't make me ring the bell. I'll ring the bell. I'll do it. There is no bell. The metaphorical bell. I
don't know. Is that a boxing reference?
I don't know. I really don't. I don't know.
Okay.
Sure.
Great.
Why not?
So we brought in boxing aficionado Vera Drew to break down all of our favorite idioms about boxing. JK, we're here to talk about The People's Joker, which I fucking love. I fucking love this movie. It's so many things,
and
we
you.
Have
That's
so many questions. Yeah, no, we brought you on to be like, fuck your movie, and frankly, fuck you. You know, that was what we were hoping to do today. No, I am kidding. God damn it, I'm out of control today. So for listeners, The People's Joker is not a boxing film. It is a queer coming-of-age comic book parody, and I love every part of that description. I like queer coming of age. I love comic book. I love parody. And then you just put it all together. And I honestly didn't know what to expect. Or actually, you know what I thought? I think I did think I knew what to expect. I was like, oh, this is going to be funny and biting. And it'll definitely be insightful. And, you know, like 4 minutes in, I'm like, oh, it's deeply profound and also upsetting. Okay, I love it, and I want more of this. My wife and I are both trans, and we watched the movie, and we were just brought to tears so many times. Actually, the first time we sat down to watch it, it was like the conversation between like baby Joker the Harlequin and her mom about being in the wrong body in the car. And my wife was like, well, I'm not in a mentally healthy place to be watching this at the moment. So I'm going to tap out and you go ahead and enjoy your little screener movie. And yeah, I want to watch it, but not today. So then, you know, 3 weeks later, we watched it again. And I saw it, you know, multiple times. So before that, and then, you know, anyways. But it was just such, I think, a profound experience. And I want to know a little bit about exactly that, the balancing this sort of frenetic humor, this sort of caustic humor in some points, with these deeply real, heartbreaking conversations, montages. It takes lots of different forms. And I'm curious for you as the creator, as the person telling their life story, how did you weave your way through the comedy and the tragedy? And how did you find the ways to, I don't know if the word balance is right, but I guess, again, like weave them together?
I guess I kind of thought about it just sort of like how like a one-person show would go, or like a stand-up routine. You know, I was thinking a lot about Hedwig and the Angry Inch, like while we were writing it, and just how like that show and the movie specifically really like weaves just heavy, heavy stuff with historical context and, you know, dick jokes. And it really, there's seemingly no rules to it. It kind of just flows together. And like, I think what's nice about it, you know, especially with that movie, and I think that was like kind of what I was going for with this, like every time I watch Hedwig, like sometimes things will play comically to me, and then other times I'll be crying. Like, I think there's like this one sequence in particular where she's just like sitting on like a bunch of tires in a junkyard, and she's got like cold sores all over her lips and stuff, and she's telling this like gut-wrenching story, I think, like about her childhood. And like, I remember like the first time I watched it, it was just played like comedy to me, and the last time, most recently, I was like kind of just bawling through the whole thing. What I kind of wanted to go for was like capturing, I guess, just sort of the way that I'm also just used to trans people talking. Like, I feel like a lot of us do kind of like slide in and out of being really funny and then dropping something super heavy and probably inappropriate to like be brought up in public. Like, I'm a wildly autistic person and often am putting my foot in my mouth. So I think it was just kind of like giving myself the permission to sort of throw all that at once. And it's been cool watching it, you know, with different audiences, because I've seen people have the experience you described, like from your partner having, like, of, you know, watching that first 20 minutes for a lot of us is very hard to watch. Like, if you had any level of like gender dysphoria when you were growing up, but it, you know, at least in the theatrical space, it sort of seems dependent on the time of night. Like, I've when we've watched it as like a midnight movie, and you know, people have had a few drinks or other stuff, a lot of that first 20 minutes just plays like a really fucked up comedy, like especially the stuff in the psychiatrist's office. And yeah, I don't know. I don't really know if that answered your question, but like, I think my intent was to make something that could kind of be viewed a few different ways depending on the mood you're in when you're watching it.
I love that. And I can see how that's the case, because I've at one point when we were rewatching it, my wife was crying. I didn't realize I was looking at the movie, and I was laughing really hard at what was happening on the screen. And then I looked over and she was crying, and I was like, oh wait, is this like sad? And I think that's what I was asking in a way, was like, hey, am I wrong emotionally? No, that's a whole different, I'll ask some like a therapist that question. But you know, like, is like, what's so powerful, I think, about the line between comedy and tragedy is lots of people put it in different places. And I hear you saying, like, even depending on what timing the film was played, that line fell in different places. And that's really fucking interesting to me.
You know, I remember getting feedback on an episode of my old web series, Hot Topics, that I did, that was like kind of, it was like masquerading as like a brief introduction to like what emo music was, but really it was just like an excuse for me to talk about like my dead grandfather, who was like a Freemason and kind of like effectively raised me at times in my life. And I got this, like, it was either like a comment or somebody tweeted at me or something and was like, you know, I love your stuff, and I don't always know if I'm laughing at it or with it or what. And that was like the comment. And it was like, I don't know. Like, I feel like some people might get a piece of feedback like that and really spiral. But for me, it meant the world, just because it was like, cool. Like, you're just having your own unique experience with it. And for me, like, that's really how I've always consumed art. Like, I don't really have like the capacity for like an ironic appreciation of things. Like Neil Breen is one of my favorite filmmakers of all time. And it's not because I'm like laughing at him. Like I think his most recent movie is like a Christopher Nolan film or something. And I watch a lot of theme park YouTubers as well, which is very sincere. You know, I've been described as cringe, but I think nothing gets more cringe than Disney adults. And I watch these just because I enjoy them. I just enjoy the entertainment value. Like I think I've done too many drugs now that I've defeated irony finally in my brain. And that's kind of what I'm hoping my art does, is that people can just watch it and just have whatever honest emotional reaction they're having.
I think what makes it hard to talk about the People's Joker is all the pieces are interconnected, right? It's so layered and cohesive. I feel like it's hard to pull the threads, but you'll have to forgive me. I'm going to pull on the threads. It is my job.
Let's do it.
And okay, let's pull on some threads. And one of them is not just being funny, which it is, but it's also about the business of being funny, right? The improv, SNL, professional stand-up route. And I've been thinking a lot about the way that trans people, as are many marginalized people, are expected to mostly be a show pony you trot out to feel bad. Like, look at the poor transes. The poor transes are so put upon. Oh, the transes. We can all feel sad about them. And being trans is actually very funny. It's a very funny experience. You have to talk about a lot of things that people don't want you to talk about. You have to render yourself visible in a really intimate way that kind of sucks a lot of the time. And I think humor is this survival mechanism as well. And so I'm curious, and you know, this isn't like a super cogent question because I wasn't planning to ask it, but I'm curious for you, what is trans comedy? And what is it about the trans experience that has a sort of different humoristic shine to it? It's just a little bit different from cis humor. I don't know. Talk to me about trans humor. I don't care what part of the question you take or if you take it in a whole different direction.
I mean, for me, like this is going to be a minefield. So qualifying all of this with just, this is my experience. Like, I think my sense of humor, especially as it relates to my gender, is very informed by my CPTSD diagnosis. Just because I really feel like, I don't know, I think there's like a level of like fourth wall breaking that I hear both myself and like a lot of other trans people who do comedy sort of have, where it's almost like no matter what venue we're in, or if it's in a movie or if it's on Twitter, or, you know, hanging out in a group of people or whatever, it's almost like we have this like Jim from the Office camera that we can turn to and sort of break the wall of reality. And for me, I think it just comes from a thin layer of dissociation that I've had to sort of build up by being in the world. And I don't mean that in a dark way. I really see it as an asset, you know, and there's this whole concept of super sanity that we talk about in The People's Joker that is something I stole from, you know, one of the all-time great gender wizards of all time, Grant Morrison, in their comic Arkham Asylum. Like they really go into this whole concept of like Joker being so crazy that like he see through the matrix code of comics, and like he knows he's a character in comics, and that he needs Batman, and that like sort of like evil Bugs Bunny vibe. And that's kind of what I think trans comedy is like, it's like Bugs Bunny getting chased by Elmer Fudd and, you know, like running off of a cliff, and then you don't start falling until you look down,
until you realize it. Yeah,
I swear I'm completely sober right now. I've only had tea right today, but like I really do think of like the trans experience as this sort of like reality breaking thing that is very magical. You know, Carta Mornier always says like being trans is a gift, and like I really think of it that way. It's almost like this like power you have over reality, because like it or not, like society like holds gender in such important space that we're kind of breaking through the matrix code.
Yeah. My wife often talks about the religion of gender and the religion of the gender binary and how it codifies all of our rituals. And, you know, like you take an ultrasound and you're like, now I may only buy pink clothing. You know, it's like, it's just from every, from the second you're like known to the people who create you, if that's how it went down for your family, there's all kinds of families, that becomes this expectation. And how is that not also the same thing as like the divine right of kings, right? It's your divine right to be the gender we assigned you at birth based on very limited criteria. We decided to define the genders. It's like, oh, this is, seems real scientific.
Yeah. I mean, for me, like that was, I think one of the like first interviews I did about the People's Joker, like they kind of like made a point of asking about this sort of like messiah arc that is in the People's Joker and where that shows up in my own psyche. And I will fully admit, you know, I don't know. I spent most of my youth thinking that I was the Antichrist. Like I was really like, it was like a hyperfixation of mine. And like, I think just like a lot of trans people have sort of like messiah complexes that they have to confront because of like how fucking crucified we are. And like, whether it's Dune or like the Bible, like all that shit is really just like coming of age stories, is, you know, like the whole hero's journey arc and messiah narratives, which are like very like reserved for like normally white cishet patriarchal storytelling. But the trans experience is a coming of age experience, and it is this sort of like alchemy thing. So it's like unavoidable to me. I don't know. You just mentioned the thing about like kings and stuff and like it being like this like sword in the stone thing. Like I really think that was like kind of where it came from. And the People's Joker was just like this idea that like, yeah, it's just something. It's like a birthright. Like why would I choose to shave inches of bone off my face if I wasn't destined to do that?
Well, and that's so funny because it's like inverting the thing that is put on. And tell me where I'm out of line, Vera. I'm not a trans woman. My wife is a trans woman, so I'm speaking a little bit to her experience and to some friends. So tell me where I'm out of line. But it particularly put on trans girls to be, especially white trans girls, I'll speak specifically, to be a sort of white savior. You're supposed to be a man. You're supposed to grow up and you'll do these things and those things and the other. And to then take this mantle that's put on you to be a certain kind of messiah and then to twist it and turn it into a different kind of messiah, which again, to your point, has to be deprogrammed and dealt with. Not okay to think of yourself as a messiah. But it is an incredible way to save oneself from drowning. And that really just hit me. Like I was like, holy shit, I had not thought about flipping that burden.
Yeah. And I don't think that's out of line at all. Like, I think it was something that I needed to process, was just this idea that like, I don't know, like trans people either have to be this like politically perfect beacon of like neoliberal hope, or like, you know, the fucking Blair Whites of the world. Like it's like there was no in between when I started making the movie. And for me, it's just like, I'm just like a dumb bitch from the Midwest. Like I like Mel Brooks movies. I eat hot dogs a lot. Like I am neither a hero nor a villain. So like, let's really like look at that. And I don't know. Like, I think like also just the trans experience is like in how it's like represented. Like there's this song that we use in the movie called White Devil, that we play like when she's kind of going through her like jokerification, like her basically like gender euphoria montage after she like dives into a vat of estrogen. And when I found the song, I got so excited because I was like, hey, this is like, This is like Dune 2, baby. This is like why, this is saying like why I don't think this person is a good role model or indicative of like what every trans experience looks like. I think like I also really wanted to talk about just like the trauma Olympics that we all play of like, you know, like being trans sucks, but it's obviously like a lot easier for me to be a white trans woman who's like a West Coast elite alt comedy icon than it is for people in the middle of nowhere who like come from different communities. And like, I just think like turning the Joker into Luke Skywalker is the best vehicle to kind of process that from where I'm sort of sitting. I don't know if any of that made sense or if I'm if this is...
No, it makes sense.
I've been talking about this movie for 4 years.
Are you enjoying this episode? Then hot dog! You might want to join us over on Patreon, where our patrons get early, ad-free access to episodes before they drop on the regular feed. Usually, typically. It's sometimes a few hours, but it's typically early. And in addition to that, we have hundreds of bonus episodes. Don't miss out. Join us at patreon.com/queerspec. I wanted to ask a little bit about how the film has evolved for you. 4 years is a long time to be working on this film. So originally it was, your idea was to re-edit clips from The Joker, Todd Phillips The Joker, and Suicide Squad. But then as you sort of started tackling the project, and again, correct any facts I have wrong, I'm piecing together what I've read. You know, as you sort of were wrestling with it in the middle of lockdown, let me say, you made the decision to turn it into like a feature-length fan film autofic. And I'd love to hear about like what the moment was that change happened for you when it moved from being re-edited clips from other films to being original and what that moment was like for you.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I had this memory resurface of going and seeing Batman Forever when I was like 6, and it just being like the gayest movie I'd ever seen in my life. Like it's just like fucking Jim Carrey plays a man in spandex that is screaming spank me and has like an obsessive crush with Bruce Wayne in that movie. And I just had never seen anything like that up until that point in my life. It was the first PG-13 movie I'd ever seen in a theater. Like, content was very gate kept in my house. I think the only reason I was allowed to see it was because my dad took me to see it, and he was a little bit more flexible on the rules with content, and also just that it was Batman. Like, well, this is clearly for kids, but like I remember watching it and also having just this thing of like, oh, like you can make something that's like colorful and cartoony and fun, but it's like serious and like it's operatic, and you can, you know, I didn't know that word, but like that was the thing that I was sort of like realizing watching it is like you can make stuff that like is genre for like adults and teens and stuff. And also just had this wild gender experience watching it, in particular over Nicole Kidman. And like, I don't know what it is. Like, I just know like watching her in that movie and seeing the way Batman looked at her, and like, I think she was probably one of the first like female characters I ever saw in a movie that like had a job like psychiatrist and wasn't just like, you know, like a mom character or something. And like, I felt represented by this gorgeous Australian woman as a 6-year-old boy, and kind of realized I realized I was trans, but it was an early gender revelation moment for me. So I had that memory like kind of all flood back to me at once while I was in the process of doing the remix. I also had this other idea that I had been kicking around a few months prior that was for this like horror movie that I wanted to do that was kind of like a queer body horror thing about a drag queen who was physically addicted to irony and like basically like needed it to survive, but it was also eating her from the inside out and like kind of just turning her into this mutant. And both of those ideas, I think, kind of hitting me at once, and it all kind of being like, okay, like I've never seen like a parody of like superhero movies, really. Like there's like, I think like there's Epic Movie or something, or you know, like they did it a little bit in one of those like Scary Movie knockoff movies. But also, like, I've never seen one that is, like, autobiographical and really, like, vulnerable. And the idea of, like, making something so ridiculous aesthetically and narratively, but taking it so seriously and really telling it from this, like, honest place, I really think, like, it all kind of just hit me at once exactly what the movie was. And I remember being in my apartment working on it and just, like, I'm pretty sure I started crying because I was like, oh my God, like I have to do this. Like if I don't do this, I will regret it for the rest of my life, because this is like, it was like the first time I think I ever really had something like that where like a movie or like an idea, like a fully formed idea kind of clicked for me all at once. And I wasn't afraid about what people thought about it. It was just like, oh, this is something I need to make to make a connection to that kid that saw Batman Forever and sort of understand at that point the last, like, you know, 31 years of my life.
So when the film first premiered, this was 2022, right? I believe. And it was at TIFF, the Toronto International Film Festival. It showed once, and from what I have read from the LA Times, that was in part due because TIFF fought for it. Then, because you'd received the letter from DC, you pulled it from that festival, and then I think maybe 6 or 7 others it was supposed to also show at. Of course, they sent you the letter like a few hours before it was supposed to premiere at a midnight showing, I believe. And that sounds like it was fucking hell. I'm sure that was a fucking nightmare. And I'd love to hear about it. No, I would love to hear about your reflections now that you're, you know, another 2 years out from that. And then, I'm not aware of the story of how it got out of this sort of distribution limbo and into our hands. So I was wondering if you could tell us just a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, it was the most traumatic experience in my life, which is saying a lot because I've had a pretty traumatic life. But I really...
I've seen the movie. I agree.
Yeah. It sucked. It sucked ass. But it also was like the first time any institution ever went to bat for me, and you know, TIFF really like vouched for the movie and said, no, like we're gonna screen it. Like it's clearly a parody. It's clearly a movie just made by a mentally ill trans woman in her bedroom. So it's not, there's no threat to you guys or your stupid Joker musical. I'm of course paraphrasing, but I ended up pulling it from the remaining film festivals, partially for like legal concerns, but it was more so just because, like, first of all, we had our like midnight screening at TIFF, and it was just like, it was the best screening we ever had of the movie. Like, it was, there was like 600 or 800 people or something in the audience. Like, it was in the oldest operational theater in North America. Just, you could barely hear most of the jokes because people were laughing throughout the whole movie. Like it was like a fucking concert. So I had this like beautiful night, and then I woke up the next day and my face was in every single trade in Hollywood dressed like the Joker. And above that picture was the phrase rights issue. So I quickly realized, like, huh, well, a lot more people know about this movie now, and they know about it specifically from this sort of like legal concern area. The fact that Warner Brothers doesn't agree that it's a parody. And, you know, like to be clear, like when I was taking it out to film festivals, like I was taking it out to find distribution. Like I didn't really even know what a film festival was before we got in. Like to me, like the People's Joker up until it got into TIFF was the kind of movie that you play at warehouse parties, or that you find on Pirate Bay or like weird dark corners of the internet. But once I realized like it's potential, I was like, I'm going to try to get this into a film festival to see if we can like get a distributor on board. So that next day after that first screening, like I really kind of watched those dreams just like vanish before my eyes. And like I said, too, it was just like a lot more people knew about the movie at that point because it like went viral and everybody in LA wanted to like meet with me and hear the story and stuff. And I kind of realized like I needed to hit pause for a second just because like the movie also wasn't completely done. Like the TIFF cut was very much a fresh paint job. It had a lot of music in it that I would never have been able to clear. The VFX were not done. It was very messy. And it was messy because like I was finishing it right up until the moment I left for TIFF. Like it was like 5 minutes before we were supposed to leave for the airport. And my partner was like, you got to hit export on the project. Like we got to go premiere this, Vera. And I hadn't slept for days. So,
wow.
You know, the TIFF cut, you know, watching it at TIFF was the first time I think I ever watched. It was the second time I ever watched the movie in its entirety, like as a movie and not just like in individual scenes, just because of how long it took to like render out and stuff. So I needed to like slam on the brakes a little bit, finish the movie. I also, and people can look this up, but I had to replace the original voice of Lorne Michaels. And I also kind of like needed like this reality check of like, okay, like this isn't going to be a normal indie movie. Like we can't just take it out to festivals and stuff. Like we've got to be like a lot more patient with it. And I wanted to sort of return it to its like punk DIY roots by like doing underground screenings and these kind of like low visibility screenings where we would, you know, like for instance, I did a whole secret tour in Australia in April of last year. And we would advertise a movie as an untitled, perfectly legal queer coming of age clown movie or something like that. And then in the description, we would say, a comical jokester faces off against a caped superhero. Like really just describe the plot of the movie without using any of the IP words. So if people would read that and they knew about the People's Joker, they'd see that and they'd go, oh, I think this is a People's Joker screening. And if they didn't know what it was, they'd be like, this just sounds really weird. I got to go see this movie. So, we kind of like maintained our buzz that way. And I did a handful of like secret screenings like that in the US too. After that, like we did this one in this little town in Virginia called White River Junction. That's like one block. And it was a screening that, you know, I have like way too many agents and stuff now. And they all like tried to talk me out of doing this. They were like, why this place? And I was just like, cause this is the kind of place. It's like a small town. I mean, it's Virginia. So like, you know, they're going to vote blue, but like, it's a small shitty town. Like, let's just like do this. Like, let's give this to, and like, I was right. Like every single queer person in the state of Virginia showed up to that screening and it was beautiful. Like it would just felt like I felt this instant connection with the audience and it healed a lot of the stuff that I had gone through at TIFF. Cause again, it was like very intense. If I was 15 years old and not myself, but I knew who Vera Drew was. And like, I heard about the whole TIFF story and I'd be like, that's fucking punk rock. Like I want to be that bitch. I want to be that big titty bitch. And like the reality of it is like, nobody wants to be like a band filmmaker on their first movie, you know? So I needed to kind of heal that. And that sort of like downtime really gave me that. And then we finally had our first public facing screening again in July of 2023. And that was very strategic. Like I really, it was at a film festival called Outfest, which is if you look them up, they're horrible on labor. Like, I don't support anything they've really done besides programming my movie. And really, like, the only reason they played the movie was because their film programmers were so cool that year. They just had brought in all these, like, really awesome film programmers, and I think had gotten a lot of shit in previous years for A, playing stuff that wasn't very indie, and also just not really having good trans representation. So we held out for them. And, you know, the other amazing thing about getting them on board was they're literally sponsored by Warner Brothers. Like, there are red carpet photos from that film festival with me dressed in slutty purple lingerie standing under the Warner Brothers sign. Like, it really, it was this like victory, you know, like, it was just right. And then it was that screening that Frank, I swear I'm almost done talking. Sorry. I just got to condense a year and a half.
Never stop.
It was that screening that Frank Jaffe, who is literally the only person, like Altered Innocence, which is my distributor, is a company of one person. It's this guy, Frank Jaffe, who's just this lovely, the only good cis gay guy. you can use that, but I'm gonna do something I've never done before and say I'm just kidding.
Obviously excluding all the cis gays who come on the pod. We love them.
Yes.
But otherwise,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But he, you know, he was exactly the kind of person, because like I knew I wanted an established queer film person that was willing to sort of go to bat for us. And so I kind of had figured that it would be like, you know, a sweet gay boy from Florida, and sure enough it was, thank God. And he texted me the day after that screening and was like, hey, do you want to get breakfast? And I just thought, I didn't get my hopes up, because I'd had plenty of meetings like that at that point. Like, the biggest distributors and the industry were interested in this movie at various points. And I won't say which ones, but you all can guess. So I didn't get my hopes up. I just thought, like, maybe he just wanted to get me some coffee. And I got there and he gave me this like stack of DVDs from Altered Innocence. Knife at Heart was one of them. Wild Boys, After Blue, Dirty Paradise, Dressed in Blue, all these amazing queer films. So I was already like, oh, you're giving me like free shit. Like, cool. And then he was like, I think we can do this. Like, I think I can distribute this movie. And I couldn't believe it. But, you know, in retrospect, it's like that whole journey, everything I just described, it was all leading up until that moment. And he was always the right person. And at the end of the day, like, I mean, I still talk about TIFF in therapy. Like, it's still something that, like, I'm still processing in a lot of ways. But in my moments of clarity and when I'm feeling really grounded and good, I know that it was always supposed to be like that. It always was that. Mm. If only because so many more people found out about the movie when Warner Brothers tried to bury it.
Ugh. I mean, wow. What a fucking terrible journey. But I'm really glad, like you say, that it made it to Altered Innocence, because that is the right place for it.
Definitely. Thanks for letting me ramble about it. I so rarely get to like talk about the whole thing. So
I love it. I mean, I'm just like looking at all my questions being like, are you sure we can't keep you for 7 hours? Which obviously we can't, because none of us can do that. But it's amazing. Filmmakers do the real talking.
I'll stop.
Okay, fine. I'll join in. I'll be the laugh track. From the like first frame of the film, it is so engaging and grabbing and comic booky. And I think part of what makes The People's Joker feel so comic booky is the way that it's multimedia and the use of animation, monologue, lots of green screen, fake TV and news shows, all those pieces. You know, even when I was rewatching it, when Joker the Harlequin goes to the fifth dimension and meets Mix Mixelpick, even, there are these, they look like reflective surfaces that are showing clips from the film back to us in this sort of big climax moment. And that all feels very comic booky. And at the same time, it's also a product of 150 different people came together to collaborate on this. And that's designers, performers, visual effect artists, animators, musicians. It is such a collaborative film. And at the same time, such a personal film, such a, you know, Vera is the one who had to write this film, had to do all the pieces. And I'm curious about, for you, what was it like to share the actual process of creating something so personal in at so many levels with so many different animators and all those pieces? And then I'm curious, when you think about it, like, what is that layered nature of the process, the layered nature of using multimedia? What does that bring to the film?
Well, I think the collaborative effort takes all the pressure off of me, like, while I'm in it. I think auteur theory is bullshit. Like, and unfortunately, it's like all they teach people in film school and just in film crit, too. It's like the director is everything. And really, to me, like, the director kind of should be the gentle but firm hand that guides everything and kind of finds the cohesive, you know, through line through it all. And I think I wanted to teach myself that in the process. And when I announced what I was doing and that I wanted help doing it, you know, I just had all these like amazing, talented artists like come out of the woodwork wanting to help me. And, you know, everybody would send me examples of their art and stuff. And it was just like all so beautiful. And I didn't want to micromanage. I wanted everybody to kind of bring their own specific aesthetics to the film and not like force my vision into theirs. You know, like I would kind of go to somebody and be like, yeah, the perfect example. And I've never used this one before, actually. One of our composers for the score is this super talented person. The artist's name is Elias in the Air. And originally I went to them and was like, I can't remember like what cover song. Maybe it was Gloria or it was something like that. It was some like 80s pop song. And they were like really struggling with it. And I think afraid to tell me that they were struggling with it. Because like when I followed up with them, they were like, yeah, I'm still working on it. I don't really know. Like, I don't really know how to make like that song dark. And I was like, oh, okay, well, what do you want to do instead? And because I just liked their music and just like wanted their music in the movie. And I think they wanted to just like make some original music. So I was like, well, how about this? Like, how about, you know, we have this like Smilex sequence in the movie where that's basically like our conversion therapy in the movie. It's a lot more fun than it sounds if you haven't seen the movie. I was like, I want to make something that's like scary and dark, but like also feels like something you'd hear at like a rave. And that immediately like clicked for them. So I sent them like a bunch of samples of my Joker laugh, and they just took that and like went off and just did it. And you know, when you do something like that, when you're working that loosely, you don't really know what you're going to get back. But that's the excitement of it, is like, you know, you wake up the next day and it's just like, oh my God, like this is like this beautiful, like crazy intricate piece of original score that I now have for my first film. And there's something fun too about like, you know, describing my vision to somebody and sort of just seeing how they interpret it. Like, you know, the Mixelplick puppet is the perfect example, where I told Maddie Forrest, the person that designed it, like I wanted it to kind of, you know, we had made some concept art for it, because we did concept art for all of the characters in the movie, like Poison Ivy and my Joker and Penguin and stuff, because I wanted them to be like original versions of these characters. We weren't like pulling from any of the pre-existing ones except for the Jared Leto Joker for our toxic boyfriend character.
I mean, you can't not. That's just there.
Yeah, it's just a no-brainer. But the Mixelplick one, I was like, okay, like I want it to kind of look like Sid and Marty Krofft, like the kind of, you know, Banana Splits, like 70s kitschy thing. And I don't know, like just like when I look at the movie, I'm like, yeah, it's kind of that. But like she just took that idea and ran with it, you know? And like, that was the thing that was always so cool about it, is like what I'd get back would be sort of what I was picturing, but not, you know, like have this extra layer of somebody's talent and like what they're actually good at. And I think like the part of it too, that takes the pressure off of me, and to answer the second part of your question of just like, what is the mixed media thing? It makes the text itself feel queer, that there are all these different aesthetics and perspectives in there. Because it was a very like diverse team of people from very different, you know, experiences of gender and just life and all around the world too. And I feel like those perspectives, since it's, you know, very, everybody's like working from a very like personal place on like what they're doing and like leaning into their specific talent and aesthetic that they normally work with, like you feel all those different identities sort of blended into it. And I was never worried about being lost in the shuffle there. Like it was always like, I knew it was only going to make me look better, and it mythologized it for me. Like, it's funny because like when I do watch it, it does feel like at this point, even though it's so based on my life, like Joker the Harlequin is very different than me. And it's a very, I think that just comes from the sort of aesthetics that we ended up playing in.
Yeah. So currently I am a film student, and it's really funny because I just decided to go to school to get my film degree because I never had the opportunity to do so. So all of my films are like completely DIY, punk, et cetera, because I also have a background in doing like punk shows, blah, 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 blah. And I'm just really curious about what your film school experience was like, because I'm experiencing some things and I'm not entirely sure how to process them. But just like, was it equally traumatic, or did you get some essential life skills from it? Or both?
I think both. You know, I think film school, its real primary function should just be the technical thing of just having access to equipment, hopefully having access to computers that don't crash when you try to render huge video files and stuff. From a networking perspective, you know, like I have friends that I made from film school, but like, this is no fault but my own, but I really didn't fit in with the other students. I think it was partially because like I was coming in knowing that I wanted to be a multi-hyphenate. Like I wanted to direct, I wanted to edit, I wanted to like act, and just the kind of like DIY thing that you were saying. Like I was kind of coming at it from where I had been at that point in my life. I was a comedian very young. Like I started doing sketch comedy and improv when I was a teenager, and was kind of coming from that sensibility. And it was hard because, you know, like I think like I was surrounded by like straight cis boys who like were writing like heist movies and shit like that. Nothing against heist movies, but the ones straight people make, no good.
I get it.
Yeah. So really, I mean, like, just to inject some solution into this, it was about 2 years in that I took my first animation class. And that was when it clicked for me, like, oh, okay, well, I'll continue to take these production classes. And I took directing and, you know, because I took everything. Like, I didn't really have a specific area of focus as far as film went, which in retrospect, I don't really recommend. I wish I had just made the film focused directing, but I ended up having this double major in animation, because with animation, it was like just me. I didn't have to like really like work and learn with other people as much. And for my thesis film, I ended up making, I don't know if it's online or not, but it was this movie called Jacunda Speaks that was like this kind of like love story that's happening between this like librarian and this lawn gnome. And it's very sincere and kitschy, and it has like a live action and animation sort of hybrid to it. And it was like, that was my kind of workaround, was okay, like I'm going to make smaller things that don't require me to have like a bunch of gaffers and people that I have to like try to wrangle because everybody's hungover in film school too, myself included. I was, and then I could kind of just like make the meat of it, these like animation things, and also just like getting into experimental stuff. Like I really got into experimental film and Kenneth Anger and Maya Darren and stuff, like all these people who just shot stuff in warehouses. So I don't know if that answered your question.
I want to give you props for mentioning Maya Darren. Maya Darren is like one of my major influences. Yeah, like I'm also, I consider myself to be an experimental filmmaker, though I mostly dabble in like horror, just because, you know, I love making fake gore and all that good stuff. But also there's just like an element in horror that is kind of lawless and can be fit into anyone's own life experience. And from that, I like started Audrey's Revenge film named after Audre Lorde because I wanted to put an emphasis on like the lives of like Black queer women and like the things that we experience. And I definitely like wanted to borrow from my own life experience, but also the films that I grew up with, because for me growing up, like cinema was like my safe space. It was the space where I could go and yeah. disassociate and let's be real, hyperfixate on, you know, these fictional characters that I like internalize. And I noticed that like in People's Joker, there are some references to like, you know, Goodfellas. Like I definitely recognize that scene, and I just like had to laugh out to myself. It was like, I love it when we put Easter eggs in our movies and like how it kind of hints towards like, you know, where we get inspiration from our screenwriting. And I'm just curious to know, like, I know you just mentioned Maya Darren, who you took influence from, but are there any other particular films that you referenced while writing People's Joker?
Yeah. Man on the Moon. The Milos Forman movie about Andy Kaufman. That's the whole reason our CG Lorne Michaels is barefoot, actually, because for some reason they like cut to Lorne Michaels, who's playing himself in Man on the Moon, and he's like sitting barefoot on this chair. I'm like, why are you making me look at Lorne Michaels barefoot? Like, that should be a hate crime. King of Comedy a little bit, but I think only more so in terms of like how much Joker 2019 was kind of like referencing to that. Return to Oz was a huge one for me. That's one of my favorite films of all time. You know, especially like the childhood stuff was very much supposed to kind of be this like homage to the Dorothy in Return to Oz, who's essentially being gaslit into believing that her journey to Oz with Scarecrow, Tin Man, and Cowardly Lion was all just in her head. It's a really fucked up movie that ruined a lot of childhoods, mine included. And I love it. Ferruja Balk's in it. I'm trying to think of what else. Oh, RoboCop. I mean, RoboCop and like Starship Troopers. Like for me, like the whole like structure of the movie was like both like a 90s Scorsese movie and terms of like it being this kind of big life, you know, showing somebody's life over the course of like a few decades and 90 minutes with like a bunch of pop music was very much like this like 90s Scorsese thing. And then also just Paul Verhoeven, who's like probably like one of my favorite directors of all time. I really love RoboCop. I really love Starship Troopers and Showgirls. Showgirls is another one too. I think like Joker the Harlequin, my portrayal of her is definitely at times me doing Nomi Malone in Showgirls, right down to some of the dance moves I'm doing. And then, you know, I love David Lynch as well. Like, I don't think there was any specific David Lynch things that I was kind of pulling from just because, like, I don't really like when people, like, just, like, rip him off. You know, like, I like being influenced more so by, like, his spirit of just like how he makes stuff. And I think like, I don't know that I ever would have made The People's Joker if I hadn't watched Twin Peaks The Return, just because like that was this big 18-hour art piece that he clearly didn't have a lot of time or money to make. So he leaned into that aesthetic of and his limitations and made this thing, this big, beautiful thing that is kind of just about everything. Like watching that show just like broke my brain and made me like a better artist and pulled me firmly out of my 28-year-old ass when I saw it. And I needed it at that point because I was really stuck in the edit bay. So yeah, I think those are some. I'm sure I'm missing some, but yeah.
That's cool. And I'm also curious because, you know, as filmmakers, we definitely rely on potential sponsorships or just like, you know, being able to pay what we can or just grab our friends together and make a film. And it's, especially for marginalized groups, it's very hard to get signed by like major studios or to get like a contract. And also I think that that type of style for the industry is on its way out with the introduction of like AI, et cetera. But also, like, I did notice that, like, you know, in 2020, after the George Floyd protests, there was, like, a lot of, like, I won't call it fake momentum. Well, can I call it fake momentum? I guess. I don't know. Of people being like, you know, we need to be more inclusive. We need to get, yes, you know, a little bit of everybody from this place and this place. So then, like, people think that, you know, these three corporations in a trench coat actually care about you. I'm curious to know, like, is your experience at TIFF was wild, and I've been to TIFF for just like it's craziness.
Yeah.
So I commend you for coming out of that alive. I'm curious to know, you know, like where do you see, and this is like a very broad question, you can also just like make this as personal as possible, where do you see marginalized groups, whether it be BIPOC, queer and trans, like where do you see filmmakers like in the world of film or television or any actual media in the coming days, especially because so many things, there's been like this like whole flip-flop of trying to get rid of like quote-unquote DEI whatever and saying that there's like special privileges for us to like get like our stories made.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean I want to say like I'm very lucky in a lot of ways, but even my experience aside, like I really am optimistic for the future, to be honest, for like filmmakers from those groups that you mentioned, mostly because I now have had the experience of like going to a lot of different film festivals, especially like in genre film festivals. And like, it seems like there's a lot of people out there that are, you know, kind of making these films from these different communities and like from the middle of nowhere. It's very easy for me to be cynical if I'm only looking at the industry in Los Angeles, which is very cis, very straight, very white. There's a handful of like, I mean, this is like a humble brag, I guess, but like there's a handful of like executives at pretty big studios that love The People's Joker and would love to make a Vera Drew movie, but you know, maybe a Vera Drew movie that doesn't have like a trans woman in the lead or isn't about like toxic lesbians. But that said, like the industry is so much bigger than it's ever been. You know, I'm gearing up for my next film right now. Like we're working on getting financing and we're casting it. And it's a movie that I was paid to write. You know, I got development money to write this movie. And I was told my entire career that that doesn't happen. My entire career. I was told that it doesn't happen, especially for artists like me, you know, weird homos. And it like really restored my faith in just the fact that like, okay, there are like people out there willing to spend money. It's just like that was this small production company based out of Canada that showed interest. And, you know, we are in the process of getting a production company on board with it. And I won't say which one, but they're, you know, they're based in LA, but like it's two people, you know. So that's all to say, like, I think the future is indie and like it's working with like the people with the money and stuff, but it's not working with these like big studios because they are, I think, kind of on their way out.
Yes,
maybe not.
That's what I,
like it could change.
I hope so.
You know,
I'm praying
it could change.
I mean, I'm just thinking about like how, you know, with the advent of like people being able to like upload their films to like Vimeo or YouTube, or even just like hosting their own shows like in DIY spaces, like at a record store or any other micro cinema. I totally agree with you that we are coming to like this return of, you know, I won't say underground, but a movement that is by people that actually love making film and not only in it yes. for profit margins.
Yes. Yeah. 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 That's, I see it too. And I mean, yeah, it's specifically in like micro cinemas and stuff too. Like I mean that small town that I mentioned in Virginia and, you know, we screened The People's Joker in Wichita, Kansas, which is a city, but like it's fucking Kansas. It's a small place. Like there are all these like film communities in these places, like people that actually give a shit about film and genre film specifically. Like I'd say like to any quote unquote marginalized, because like let's face it, there are more of us than there are of them, folks. Like if we all stopped fighting, we could probably
thank you
work in a studio, you know, just go camp outside of fucking Occupy Warner Brothers. Anyway.
Oh my God. Next summer, let's do it.
Listen, Monica and I are packing our bags. I'm gonna hop on a train. I'll see you all in LA.
Oh God, yes. What have I done?
I was about to say, what have you started? I feel like you've done a thing.
I mean, look, if somebody comes and picks me up, I'll join in. I got a megaphone, and a tent. Oh, the other thing with the AI shit, I mean, the long and short of it is it's the same thing. Is like, I think big studios are going to replace people with AI, but I'm not Prince over here and saying like AI is just a trend like Prince said about the internet. But I do think like the sort of like, you know, just writing like a plot of a movie into like a piece of software that like spits out the next Flash movie or whatever. Like, I don't really see that taking over. And I think audiences are already fucking sick of it. You know, like I think they're already really growing tired of it. You know, I've gotten a lot of shit for sort of my nuanced takes on AI. Like, I really do think of it as a tool. I think the generative AI and all that stuff that's like pulling from people's libraries without their knowledge and anything like that is obviously like, I don't think we should be using AI in an exploitive way. But to me, it's like another tool that can kind of democratize filmmaking in a way if it's used right and if it's used in these situations where we're not harming our environment or putting people out of work. And in a world where big studios are using AI or generative images and stuff, like the human creator is going to be more valuable. And maybe this is like too new agey or whatever. Like, I'm definitely not saying like, let's shake hands with the machines. Like, I'm saying like, let's make them our bitches and accept the fact that audiences are always going to prefer something made by people. And I think in a world now where like anybody can make stuff, like we kind of needed that value of the human creator to return in a way. I think a lot of untalented people are going to be making art over the next couple decades, and that's only going to make all of us look better.
Agreed.
I saw a tweet on this that is just like so perfect. And they said, leave it to generative AI to make me believe in the concept of a human soul. And I was like, that is such a good way of putting it, because it's like that ineffable quality of like, we're all fucked up weirdos. Like, I don't think the AI has daddy issues. I mean, if it can have as many, you know, issues as I have, then maybe it can create the stories I can create. But I feel like I don't want to put the AI through that. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't deserve that.
Yeah.
I'm all worried about the AI getting traumatized.
That's really fun. That's, somebody should make that movie. That's like really like being afraid of passing on your
isn't like Terminator 2 about that? I don't know. I feel like, yeah, that might be a thing. Holy shit, I feel an essay coming on. I don't know.
I don't know. Have you all seen the articles about the guys who are just abusing their AI girlfriend chatbots? That's like, oh, it's so bad. It's so bad. Jesus. It's like, oh my God. And so like, you know, we're all like, oh, I would never want to hurt it. That's not how these gentlemen are behaving.
Okay. All right.
neither here nor there, but also would make a great horror film. And I'm talking to filmmakers, so, you know, I got to put my pitches in. Well, you know, Vera, wow. Like I said, I would keep you here for 7 hours if I could. You know, we didn't even get to talk about some of the coolest parts. Well, not, there's lots of cool parts. It's all cool parts. It's cool parts from the first minute to the last, people. But, you know, like the way that, you know, you're so careful with how the character's dead name is used when, you know, like how hard it must have been to parody anti-trans propaganda, because it's like it's so absurd on its own. Like at some point the parody just isn't parody. I don't know, different conversation, different day. You know, and then there's the representation of queer intimate partner violence, which we do not have enough on TV and film. You know, oh, the representation of a T for T and how cute T for T couples are. Thank you, extremely cute. But you know, like,
yeah,
there's so much to talk about, so much to talk about, so much to see in the film. I really hope that everyone who's listening will take the time to seek it out. I know it's on video on demand. I saw on your Instagram that there's also DVDs available, VHS available, and I think Blu-ray. It's like it's out of stock now, but it's coming, like there'll be more soon. So maybe by the time you're listening to this, listeners, there might be more Blu-rays. I mean, if you like our podcast, you need to go see The People's Joker. I don't think there's anything that I can say other than that. Again, unless we get another 7 hours now, but I'm going to go, you know, smoke weed. So we're not going to do that. But, you know, I really do think this is like a Bitches on Comics, like kind of movie. If we had like some kind of stamp I could give you, Vera, you have the stamp.
Oh, wow.
We fucking love it. Yeah. You know, and it's a pretty valuable stamp. No, it's not. I don't even know what I've co-signed.
It's valuable, Effie. It's valuable.
Okay. We need to create like a comics code, but like gay. But like, you know, it's like this must break the comics code in order to get our stamp. Is, you know, that's what I'm going with. I know that you are a huge, huge Harley Quinn fan, Joker fan, big DC Comics nerd. Like the deep cuts in this film, so delightful. I had such a good time talking to you. I have such a good time when I watch the film. Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. Thank you for putting your heart and soul into something and making something that I think it is one of a kind. And I hope it's not the last. Like, I would love to see so many more movies like The People's Joker, where people take these big iconic characters and bring them home, make them personal, tell me something autobiographical through this lens, this archetype, frankly, that the Joker and Harley Quinn, among many other characters, have become. I hope this is the sort of domino that sets off just a series of kick-ass films like The People's Joker. I know they're out there and I know people are making them, but I hope that this will show that there's a great desire for that. We want these kinds of stories that are all the things: funny, cute, sweet, fucked up, upsetting, profound, all of the above. And left me just, you know, a little happier that I was still alive, frankly. So I'm really, really grateful. Aww. And I'm curious for you, Vera, is there anywhere folks can follow you online that you want to share?
Yes, I am unfortunately on Twitter at VeraDrew22. Also Instagram, TikTok, but I barely use it. But you can follow me in those places and thepeoplesjoker.com for how to watch it. We have a lot of screenings still. Like, it's going to be in theaters forever. Like, it's the never-ending theatrical run. And I can't recommend the theatrical experience enough. I know we'll be back in Chicago soon, the UK in December, and handful of other places. So go to thepeoplesjoker.com and for more. Thank you guys for having me. This was so nice. I always feel bad whenever I go on podcasts. Like, I know people want me to talk and they want to hear what I have to say, but like, I can't shut the fuck up when there's a microphone in my face.
But that's the best kind of guest for a podcast. Truly. Listeners, if you didn't have a pencil out, don't worry. You don't have to remember everything Vera said. I will link to it in the show notes. So I think next to the title of this episode, there might be like a little carrot or there might be three dots. I don't know. You live on the internet, don't you? Click whatever the internet thing is. It'll open it up and there'll be links there. So you can follow Vera and definitely go to thepeoplesjoker.com. I am going to go check that out, see if there's any showings near me because I think it would be an incredible theatrical experience. So if you live near me and you want to go together, no, don't, you don't know where I live. Don't call me. You don't know me. I never existed. I'm going to fade into the ether. Vera, you're the fucking best. Oh my God. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Monica, you know, I think that you are the sun, the moon and the stars on high.
Wow.
Right?
Listen, I mean it. I mean it. Oh, it's sweet. Real.
Stop.
I will never stop. I will always flatter my friends. you deserve it. The world's bullshit, and I know you fucking rule. Kate, thank you for cutting out every time I flubbed a line or got too excited or mispronounced my own name. I greatly appreciate you making me sound very thoughtful. Because that's what I try to be. Listeners, we obviously couldn't be here without you. I mean, I guess we could, but that'd be kind of weird. Patrons, we actually couldn't be here without you. So thank you. Thank you for your money. Please give us more money. Or anybody who wants to give us money, we will take your money. And you know what? I love everybody today. I love everybody who's queer and trans. And I love everybody who's given a fuck. Great job, team. That's the app, y'all.
You're listening to Bitches on Comics, distributed by Realm, your portal to another world. Listen away. Find more shows like Bitches on Comics by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm.
Bitches on Comics is a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Blue Sky, Instagram, and TikTok at Bitches on Comics. You can sign up for our newsletter, listen to any of our episodes, find curated lists of where to start listening, read interviews available nowhere else, and learn about our other projects and upcoming appearances at bitchesoncomics.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also buy us a coffee or send us a one-time morale boost at ko-fi.com/queerspec. That's ko-fi.com/queerspec.
You can also support the podcast by joining us on Patreon. Head to our Patreon page at patreon.com/queerspec to learn more.
I'm Essie Fleenor, and you can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Blue Sky at essiefleenor. You know, the whole thing. And on Instagram at @Essie_Fleenor.
I'm Monica Estrella Negra, and you can find me at my website, Audrey's Revenge Film, listed below. Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
If you like Bitches on Comics, you might also enjoy our narrative fiction podcast, Decoded Horror Channel, available wherever you get your podcasts or at decodedpride.com.
Be sure to check out our show notes to find a link to donate to campaigns engaged in important work.